Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Cancer is a Racket, right after this. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, that tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of this tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped from 7% to more than 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate had gone up to more than 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Well, in 1913, the average American family had to work until January 30th in order to earn enough money to satisfy the tax man at every level. Now, this year, the average American family had to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us today? Now, the income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments, and they violate eight statutes of the Old Covenant in the Bible, and it violates our English common law. The income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and the Social Security law is the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, for more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Our Tax and Status School is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about Cancer is a Racket. So last time I introduced you to a neat book called The War is a Racket, written by Smedley Butler. I liked War is a Racket because it starts off and it's very logical, very straightforward. And I said, well, you know, hell, as far as I can tell, cancer is a racket just like war is. So I've been drawing that parallel for you. Let me show you a little something here about the profit potential or the profit program that's in cancer. They got the same profit motivation, the same profit procedure. It's in war and cancer, war and medicine, because different people are profiting from it. In other words, in war, the Halliburtons and Kellogg Brown and Root and Boeing and Lockheed profit. But it's a profit that's made with government and business participation together. Medicine works exactly the same way as the war racket. It's a government medical cooperation. It's a fascist cooperation between these two entities, government on the one hand, and big business on the other that generates these great profits for the medical industry. Now, if at the same time they were curing the cancer, you know, I'd say, well, you know, more power to them. You know, it costs a little money to solve the problem. But it's just exactly the opposite. See, they tell us that the more money that we spend on defense, the safer we're going to be. So we Americans spend about $500 billion a year on defense, and we got two wars going. Two wars. And they didn't protect us from war. All of this, all these armaments out here, they don't prevent war. That's the cover story. That's what they keep telling us. This nuclear umbrella, we've been told, hey, see, that brought us peace. It prevented nuclear war because we've got all these nuclear bombs. Huh? Huh? What? Where does that line of reasoning come from? You know, one of these days that Osama bin Laden, I don't think he's got any real love for us, and I'll just bet you that one of these days he's going to come up with a nuclear weapon. He's going to get it from the Pakistanis or from the Indians. Or he's going to buy one of them suitcase nukes that the Russians lost. Or, you know, some scientist someplace is going to sneak some plutonium to him or something. The guy's got plenty of money. Now, what do you think he's going to do when he comes up with one of them nukes? Huh? Now, George Bush said that these guys are wicked and evil and that they're bad guys. And I wouldn't doubt that. You know, the world is full of bad guys. They're not everybody in the world is a Mr. Rogers, you know. There's some bad guys out there. And these bad guys, no matter who you identify as being one of the bad guys. See, now, if you're a Jew, you identify the bad guys as Arabs. If you're an Arab, you identify the bad guys as Jews. If you're politically minded, you recognize the bad guys as Democrats, unless, of course, you're a Democrat, in which case, then the bad guys are the Republicans. It hasn't occurred to too many of us over here is that, wait a minute, did it ever occur to us that maybe both these guys are bad? Maybe the Jews and the Arabs are both bad. Maybe the Republicans and the Democrats are both bad. So, you know, they keep telling us, you know, you need to vote, and I'm not here to tell you not to vote. And I'm just sitting here saying, hell, you were voting in the last two elections. That seemed to cause more problem than it solved. Didn't it? Now, if you're a real man about it, you'll say, well, I voted for the right wrong guy. Well, what in the hell makes you think you're voting for the right guy this time? I mean, everybody, when he votes, believes he's voting for the right guy. I mean, when was the last time you went into the vote to vote and you said, well, I'm going to vote for the bad guy. I'm going to vote for the war candidate. I'm going to vote for the guy that's going to cause us the most problems here. I don't know if anybody ever did that. I never run across anybody that said, gee, where can I go buy some cancer today? I don't have enough of it, and I'd like to get more. I haven't run across anybody like that. Now, when it comes to war, you know, everybody says, well, I'm the peace candidate, and I'm opposed to war. But, you know, you seem to have more and more of it. Franklin Roosevelt told us in 1940, you elect me president, and I've kept you out of the war. And no American boy will fight on foreign soil as long as I'm president. That's what he was promising in 1940. So, let's see, he was elected in November of 1940. And November of 1941, that's 1 year later, yeah, 13 months later, we were involved in war. And, of course, his cover story is very simple. Well, I didn't attack Japan. The Japanese attacked us. But what they didn't tell you now, here's what they didn't tell you, was that in 1937, President Roosevelt imposed an oil embargo upon the Japanese. An oil embargo. Now, let's put the shoe on the other foot. Let's suppose that the Arabs imposed an oil embargo upon the United States. That the OPEC nations all sat down one day and they said, okay, we're going to come up with an embargo. We'll sell oil to Russia. We'll sell oil to Indonesia. We will sell oil to Japan and Europe, but we will not sell any oil to the United States of America. Now, when you consider that we get about 70% of the oil that we use in this country from OPEC and other countries around the world, you know, if those OPEC guys were to shut off our oil, that would just cause no end to no end of problems. How long do you think it would take us to go to war against Saudi Arabia and Iran and all the OPEC members? See, I'm not surprised that World War II was the culmination of that policy, that oil embargo policy. The thing that surprised me was that the Japanese waited from 37 to 41 to attack us. I can guarantee you it ain't going to take the United States of America 4 or 5 years to attack OPEC if they impose an embargo upon us. Now, let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the United States Navy today has 6 aircraft carrier battle groups out in the Persian Gulf. You know, they're running up and down the Gulf there in front of Iran. What do you think that, what would you think? You know, just for the sake of our discussion here, if the Russian Navy or the Chinese Navy were running ships, you know, 50 miles off your coast, let's say in New Jersey, North and South Carolina, Florida, off Miami, or Los Angeles, or San Francisco, California. You know, I don't know about you, but I'd take a dim view of that. I'd say, uh-oh, that sounds kind of warmongerish to me. So, you know, if the Iranians think that we mean them harm by putting 6 carrier battle groups over there, 20, 30 miles off their coast, running up and down the coast over there, that would be my conclusion. All right, now, It takes government along with the military-industrial complex to make war. So what you do is you don't go out and attack somebody. You go out and create a false flag incident, and then you convince all of the people of your country that it was those dirty Arabs that attacked us, or it was those dirty Jews that attacked us, or it was those dirty Japs that attacked us, or those Germans or somebody else. And then you can get the war on. Well, you do the same thing here with disease. You got to make this disease thing look like that, you know, it's just an accident. You know, you're just walking down the street and gosh, you're just unlucky and you're an innocent victim and gosh, now you've got polio and oh my God, now we got, well, what are we going to do next? See, you got to have victims. Now, victims require, they demand justice. And so you got this cancer thing. It's called the war on cancer. We demand justice. We're not going to settle for anything less. Has it ever occurred to you that maybe you're the proximate cause of your own injury? Now look, you know, you eat what you want to eat, don't you? And I'm not sitting here telling you what to eat or what not to eat. But I pointed out to you in the last program that 2 doctors, I've forgotten their names now. They may come up here in the series. 2 doctors back in 1950 got to looking at this cancer thing in San Francisco, California. They're the discoverers. These are the 2 guys that discovered Laetrile. Their name isn't Laetrile. It isn't Bob and John Laetrile that discovered this. No. Laetrile, that's the name that they hung on this vitamin they discovered. They discovered that in seeds, in peach pits and apricot pits, there's a substance in there. They hung a label on this stuff called Laetrile. And they called it vitamin B17. And what they discovered was is that if people that have cancer are given this B17, the cancer goes away. Now, maybe it didn't work in every single case, but it worked in a whole bunch of cases, and it was very successful, and pretty soon these 2 doctors over here were ordered to stop doing that. But why would you want to stop these 2 doctors from doing that? The cancer establishment, you know, the Johns Hopkins and the American Cancer Society, they come right up front and say, we don't know what causes cancer, and we don't have a cure for it. These 2 guys come along and say, well, we think we know what causes cancer. We think it's caused by a shortage of this B17. And we think the cure for it is to simply give these patients the B17 that their bodies are being deprived of, and we notice that the cancer goes away. And we went over to Nepal, and we found these Hunza people, and they eat all these apricot pits, and they don't have any cancer at all. So we just put 2 and 2 together, and we said, we think this is the cure to cancer. And then these 2 guys were prosecuted for this, and I don't know if they were put in jail or not, but they were put out of business. Now, why would we want to do that? Competition. Makes all the sense in the world. Which is why I'm not anxious to march on or to walk on or to telethon on cancer. I just don't see any point in it. And that's because we do not want a cure to cancer, and if one were discovered, we would lock that sucker up in prison and throw the keys away. And we've been doing that in this country for the past 50 years. There are a number of cancer researchers that have been jailed. There was a guy by the name of Bruce Halstead. I'm going to write his name down here. Bruce Halstead. H-A-L-S-T-E-A-D. He called me on the phone here, but that's a long time ago, about 15 years ago. And he said, I'm being prosecuted. Now, this Bruce Halstead is an MD, and he was a cancer researcher. Cancer researcher. I mean, this is the guy that's taking your tax dollars and putting them to work, looking for a cure to cancer. And he'd been in this business for many, many years. And one day he woke up and he said, you know, this looking for a cure to cancer is futile. We're not getting anywhere. Let's take a look at some of these alternative cancer cures. And so he took a look at this vitamin B17. And he looked at Easter lily ovum. And he looked at vitamin mineral therapy. And he compared that with cut, burn, and poison. And he took a look at Indian black salve and Ann Wigmore and the raw food diet and one thing and another. And he came to a conclusion. He woke up one day, and I don't know exactly what his conclusion was. We didn't get into the medical aspects. We were talking about his legal problems. But he came to the conclusion that the cut, burn, and poison program was actually counterproductive, and that looking for a patentable. Now, this is what the medical industry is looking for. They're looking for a cure to cancer that they can patent. They're looking for a chemical concoction that they can patent and sell and make money off of. A wonder drug, you know, like penicillin. And hell, you know, maybe they'll come up with something like that. But if they do come up with something like that, they're never going to put it on the market, and I'm going to tell you why. Right now, today, the medical industry makes $1 trillion. It's more than that. It's 1.5 trillion, spelled with a T here. And then that was a couple of years ago, $1 trillion a year. That's what all the doctors and hospitals and nurses and all the paramedics and all these guys make. That's the medical industry, $1.5 trillion. Now it's gone up about $100 billion or $200 billion, and they expect by the year 2020 it'll be a $2 trillion industry, last numbers I saw. See, the medical industry is growing by about 5, 6, 7% a year, and it's compounded every year. So it doesn't take 20 years at 5% growth a year, see, because next year it's 105, and then the next year it's 100, and, you know, it's 5% of 107 or 8, and then it's 100% of 120, and then it's 5% of 150, and so on. So it doesn't take 20 years for it to double. It takes something less than that. Now, this is big business. It's the biggest industry in America. It makes more money. It's a growth industry. It makes more money than airlines and more money than armaments and war. And, you know, it's big business. And one-third of that, $500 billion a year, that's the same amount of money that you're spending on public education, $500 billion a year goes to cancer. That's not cancer research. That's just cancer. That's the, you know, cut, burn, and poison technique. And what these two doctors discovered is that this Laetrile, for instance, we went to the health food store the other day, and we bought a bunch of these apricot kernels. Now, here in Missouri, evidently, they're legal. They're illegal in a lot of states. Can't buy it. Period. So if you're looking for Laetrile, you probably aren't going to be able to find it. But here in this state, while you can't buy the Laetrile, you can get the apricot seeds, You know, you can still buy those. And so then you can take those home, chop them up, and put them in your smoothie, and you can get your Laetrile that way, your B17. And if you've got cancer, that's a cure. Not the cure. It is a cure. It's one of 14 cures to cancer. I use that along with a couple of other cures. Now, I want to emphasize that I can't cure anybody's cancer. And we're certainly not trying to cure cancer. You see, cancer is a monopoly. It is a copyrighted trademark brand name for a symptom that's owned by the American Medical Association. And this Dr. Bruce Halstead learned how this worked, and I explained it to him. So I'm going to explain it to you. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. See, cancer is owned like the name Coca-Cola is owned by a corporation. The AMA is a corporation. They own that trade name, cancer. Now, they have the rights to it. They sell cancer. And that's what you're buying when you go to the doctor. And he says, well, your tests are back and it's conclusive. You test positive for cancer. Now we're ready for the treatment. And he can do that because, you see, he's a licensed medical professional. He's either a member of the AMA or he's a licensed professional. Here's where the government comes in. See, the government licenses this doctor. So you come to me and you say, look, Gordon, I've got this lump on me. And I say, oh, my God, Bob, you've got cancer. Oh, Jesus. You know, you can prosecute me and put me in prison for that. That's called a diagnosis. I'm not licensed. I can't diagnose your cancer. You know, Bob, you could go to a licensed medical doctor and he could come back and diagnose you with cancer. You could come over to me and you could say, George, I just got the diagnosis back from the doctor. I've got cancer. What do you think I ought to do for that? And I could say, I think you ought to take vitamin B17. I think you ought to drink a lot of water. I think that you ought to take Laetrile. Do you know I'd go to prison for that? That's called a prescription. Hell, I can't prescribe. I can't tell you people, well, you got cancer. Well, here's what will cure your cancer. That's against the law. And that's what happened to this Bruce Halstead. Now, he's a medical doctor, see? And he's got grants and money coming in from government and private sources, and he's looking for a cure to cancer. One day he wakes up, he publishes his findings. He says, all this crap that we're looking in the test tube for is a racket. The real cure to cancer is Laetrile. The real cure to cancer is the Indian black salve, bloodroot, herbs, vitamins, minerals. That's the cure to cancer. That's what's causing our cancer problem in this country is our diet. And they prosecuted him instantly. And I told him, I said, well, Doc, look, you're a licensed medical professional. And except for surgery and radiation and chemotherapy, you cannot prescribe any other modality over here. It hasn't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So you got the pharmaceutical industry involved. You got the American Cancer Society involved. You got the American Medical Association. And you've got the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Agriculture. You got the Congress. You got the President of the United States. All of these agencies and all these institutions. And none of these institutions want a cure for cancer because it's a $500 billion a year industry. And all these doctors that are making all this money off of all these people that have cancer pay taxes. And so the Congress doesn't want a cure to cancer because out of the $500 billion a year, gross sales, I imagine the government's probably taking, 10-15% of that. Well, 10% of $500 billion, that's $50 billion a year. Now, did you want to cut the government's income tax revenues by $50 billion a year by coming up with a cancer cure? I mean, you people have got to be out of your minds. And the people that, like Bruce Halstead, that were looking for a cure to cancer, these are idealistic people. These are people that desire to have their names written in lights like Jonas Salk, the discoverer of the Salk vaccine. You know, they want to become a Louis Pasteur. They want their names written in history books, and they want to become famous, and they want to make a lot of money, and just like you and me and everybody else. But what Mr. Halstead didn't understand is that as a licensed medical professional, he has to work within the guidelines, within the standards that are set down by government. And it's a straitjacket, and it's a straitjacket on all medical research that guarantees there will never be a cure to cancer. Absolute guarantee. Well, to show you how good the guarantee is, you ain't got a cure to cancer in 100 years. They've prevented it. In spite of the fact that Laetril is out there, the average Joe Sixpack does not understand what the hell Laetril is. It's a common vitamin. It's been there since God created it back in the Garden of Eden days. When he finished the 6 days of creation, he put into seeds, like blackberry seeds, this substance that we call Laetril. He put it in there. It's a very vital nutrient. Let me give you an illustration. If we were to take vitamin C away from your diet, do you know what would happen to you? You would get scurvy. If we take vitamin D away from you, you know what happens? You get pellagra. You know what happens if we take vitamin B17 away from you? You get cancer. See how simple that is? I mean, there's no big mystery about it. You want to know what causes cancer? It's nutritional deficiency. And it isn't just vitamin B17. There are other nutrients that you need. And this is why this Laetril does not cure all cancers all the time, and that's because while it's very common and cures some cancers, there are other cancers that are caused by other nutritional deficiencies. So if you're short some other vitamin or mineral or amino acid, and you take all the Laetril that your body can stomach, you still die from cancer because you're still lacking one of these other vitamins or minerals. So jot this down. I'll give you another deep book here. It's called Rare Earths, R-A-R-E, Rare Earth, E-A-R-T-H-S, Rare Earths. And it's written by a guy by the name of Wallach, Joe Wallach, Joel, J-O-E-L, Joel Wallach. W-A-L-L-A-C-H, I believe is his last name, and J-O-E-L, Joel Wallach, wrote a book called Rare Earths. And he's an old-timey veterinarian, and here's what he discovered. He and other veterinarians figured out that what causes disease in cattle is nutritional deficiencies. And so They over time, they'd take cattle that had a nutritional deficiency, and they would analyze the tissue samples of the animal and say, this animal is short iodine. And so then they'd go back to the herd of cows or sheep or whatever, and they'd give them iodine, and suddenly their symptoms disappeared. You got healthy cattle again. And so over a long period of time, they figured out that, well, here's what causes diabetes. Here's what causes goiter. Here's what causes high blood pressure, muscular dystrophy. They discovered, you know, muscular dystrophy doesn't occur just in people. It occurs in cattle also. Now, in cattle, they don't call it muscular dystrophy. They got another name for it. But it's the muscles. You see, there's a mineral that's missing, and it's called selenium. And so they discovered that when they put selenium in a salt lick and gave it to the cattle, when these cattle developed this muscular dystrophy, here comes Jerry's kids, see? They discovered that the symptoms went away from the cattle. Now, we haven't been able to figure that out for human beings. And that's because muscular dystrophy is a cash cow. Just like cancer is a cash cow. Disease is a cash cow. Disease causes pain. Pain causes action. When you're hurting, you want relief. You go to the doctor. He gives you that relief. It's called a painkiller. And so the doctors are giving out heroin. See, they don't call it that. They call it something else. They got a name for that. Morphine. See, when you go to the doctor, he don't give you heroin. He gives you morphine. Makes you feel real good all over. And so, you know, people, they learn how to get on to morphine, and they like it real good. And so they get out of the hospital and say, well, I'd like to get some more of that. And so a guy comes along and says, well, I got a stuff here. It's called heroin. And here's this heroin stuff, and we sell you this and make you feel real good. And so people become heroin addicts. They learn that from the medical profession first. I had an old doctor explain that to me. His name was Dr. Sansoni in Eureka, California. And I'd had an accident, an industrial accident, and I was in the hospital, and he was operating on me. He said, now, after I woke up, you know, he said, well, you know, you got a little pain there. And he said, that's natural, you know, and after you've been cut on for a while, you're going to be sore and you're going to have some pain. He said, now, the protocol calls for giving you morphine. And he said, now, we can control your pain with this morphine. He said, now, this morphine over here is habit forming. It's going to make you feel real good. You'll love it. And he was right. It made me feel real good, and I loved it. That morphine's the greatest stuff since sliced white bread. But he also gave me this warning. He said, now, if you lie to me and you say that I got all this great pain, we're going to give you more morphine to control the pain, and then you're going to feel better and better. And then when you check out of the hospital, this is where all the heroin addicts come from. They come right out of the hospitals. We create the heroin addicts right here at St. Joseph's Hospital by giving them morphine, and it feels real good, and they like it. And then they go out on the street, and they want more of it, and so then they go buy heroin. He said, so if you want to become a drug addict, you know, then you're in the right place. This is where we create them right here. I thought, that's pretty candid. That's pretty honest for an old country doctor. You know, he just said, hey, this is where... I said, Doc, I'm going to just take the pain. I think the pain ain't that bad. I mean, you know, it hurts. I don't feel good. I can't open my mouth. I'll have to suck my soup through a straw, but I'll just tough it out. And I did in about 3-4 weeks. I recovered, and pain went away, and then I could open my mouth, and I'm just doing fine. And I never did get onto heroin. So I just want to pass that on to you. That makes business, and business is what we're after. And that's what Smedley Butler said about war. He said, you know, it's profitable, and then it makes money. So let's take a break here. Let me give you a reminder. And then let's take a look at the profits in war, and then we'll convert those profits to medicine. God, these guys are making money like you can't believe. Money like you just love to make. All right, now you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of the authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. But these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then we invite you to go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct, and we'll tell you more here at the law school. Just give us a jingle. The number to call is 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Cancer is a Racket, which is a takeoff from Smedley Butler's book, who wrote the book back in the 1930s. He said, War is a Racket. Now, this guy Butler is a three-star Marine general with two Congressional Medals of Honor. I mean, this guy is no lightweight. And he said this thing of war is a racket, and it's a racket. We just need to take a look at who makes the profits. Is it the soldiers that are out here fighting the war in Iraq? Are they making all the profits, or is it Halliburton and Lockheed Martin and DuPont? Now listen to this. The World War, rather our brief participation in the World War, has cost the United States $52 billion. So you figure it out. Now take our friend the DuPonts, the powder people. You know, DuPont, they make gunpowder. Didn't one of them testify before a Senate committee recently that their powder won the war? Or something like that. Now, how did the DuPont people win the war? They were a patriotic corporation. And the average earnings of the DuPont Corporation for the period 1910 to 1914 was $6 million a year. Now, that sounds like a lot of money. $6 million a year was the profits made by the DuPont Corporation in 1910, 1911, 1912, 13, and 14. That's their average. So let's take a look at their average annual profits during the war years of 1914 through 1918. They made $58 million a year profit in 1914, 15, 16, 17, and 18. Now that's nearly 10 times that of normal times. And the profits of normal times were pretty good, $6 million a year. But during wartime, their profits increased by 950%. So let's just pause right there, boys and girls, and let's ask ourselves this question. Is the DuPont Corporation against the Iraq War? As long as those soldiers are out there pulling the trigger and firing bullets, they're burning powder. Every time they fire a bullet and burn some powder, the government has to go back to DuPont and say, here, sell us some more powder to put in another bullet. And you can really burn up a lot of powder if you've got battleships shooting those 16-inch shells, and you've got bombs going off. You know, those bombs, you know, they got pounds and pounds of explosives. Now, we're not just talking about gunpowder. You know, we're talking about all of these explosives that are being used. Now, DuPont isn't the only company that makes these explosives, I'm sure of that. But, you know, the DuPont people over there are making pretty good money, 950% in World War I. World War II came along, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. Get this. In the Vietnam War, we dropped more explosives on Vietnam during that war than we did in all of World War II. Do you know that? Do you think that the DuPont Company made a lot of money in the Vietnam War? Now, I'm not opposed to war. If you think that I'm here as a peacenik and I'm over here trying to get you people to stop going to war, I couldn't care less. You know, as long as I'm not getting shot at. And as long as you young kids out there, you want to volunteer to go over to Iraq and make the world safe for Standard Oil and BP Petroleum and Shell Oil Company, I don't care. I mean, if you want to go over there and kill a bunch of slant-eyed gooks, get after it. The Army is the best place for you. But this guy Butler, who actually spent the time in the Army, 31 years in the Marines, he got shot at, you know, and he was out killing people. He came to a conclusion after 30 years in the military. He says, I was really working for the big banking interests on Wall Street. They're the guys that are making all the money off these wars. Taint the soldiers. Taint the taxpayers. So the people in power, you know, like President Bush, they've got to sell us on the war. And did you notice how they sold us that Iraq war? I mean, it's a hell of a neat sales job. They got Colin Powell to go into the United Nations with charts and graphs and photographs. And he said, these guys have got weapons of mass destruction. And so the United Nations said, yeah, we can't put up with that. And the president said, you know, we can't put up with that. And so we went to war. Then we found out there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. Remember? Then they said, well, that's faulty intelligence. No, it wasn't. It was a sales job. They all knew full well they didn't have any weapons of mass destruction, but they had to make you and me believe that they did in order to get us to back the war, which we did. So we voted for it, didn't we? Twice. Now that we got the war, you know, now you're all sitting over, well, we don't like this war over here. What the hell did you vote for it for? Well, because voting solves our problems. First of all, you had this 9/11 problem, and voting solved that problem. Well, that's what we were told. That got us a couple of wars, and then now we're taking a look at the two wars and say, well, we need to vote again because we need to end these two wars. Listen, these two wars aren't going to end. Let me tell you, watch this. Let me see if I'm a prophet in my own time. The military occupation of Iraq is going to continue on like the military occupation of South Korea. Do you know that we Americans have been occupying Korea since 1953? And we are going to occupy Iraq until they run out of oil. And then, miraculously, there will be no more need for American troops in Iraq, so we'll pull out and go somewhere else. But as long as there's a need for military personnel in South Korea, the South Koreans want us to get the hell out and go home. Leave us alone, would you? We're the guys that won't leave. We haven't left for 50 years, and we ain't leaving for the next 50. So you South Koreans, as long as there's this controversy between the North and the South, it gives us an excuse. Let's take a look at NATO. See, the Cold War ended in 1989, so what do we need NATO for? I mean, just be intelligent now for a minute. If peace broke out, and the Russians, they pulled out of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, they pulled their troops out and put them in Russia, signed an agreement with us guys over here, and they said, okay, we'll pull out of Eastern Europe and you guys pull out of Western Europe. Well, we didn't do that. Now, not only didn't we pull out of Western Europe, but we have now expanded NATO to include Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. And now we're seeking to do that in Poland and Czechoslovakia and the Ukraine and in Georgia. And, you know, the Russians are sitting over there saying, no, wait a minute. You know, we had a deal back here in 1991 with Bush Sr., remember? And you Americans and you French and you British and you Germans are reneging on our deal. And you're trying to encircle us. And we're getting damn tired of it, and we ain't putting up with it. Now, I suspect that these provocations in Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Georgia are aimed at producing war with Russia. Why? Well, listen to this. Here's what happened in World War I. Take one of our little steel companies. Remember, now this is Smedley Butler writing in 1932. He said, take a look at our steel companies that so patriotically shunted aside the making of rails and girders and bridges to manufacture war material in World War I. Their 1910 to 1914 yearly earnings averaged $6 million a year at Bethlehem Steel. Then came along the war. And like loyal citizens, Bethlehem Steel promptly turned to munitions making. Did their profits jump? Or did they let Uncle Sam in for a bargain? Well, their 1914 to 1918 average was $49 million a year. Not as good as DuPont, but getting close to it. Or let's take United States Steel. The normal earnings during the five-year period during the war were $105 million a year. Not bad. Then along came the war and up went their profits. The average yearly profit for the period 14 to 18 was $240 million a year. Twice as much. Not bad. There you have some of the steel and powder earnings. So let's look at something else. A little copper, perhaps. That always does well in war times. Anaconda Copper, for instance, average yearly earnings during the pre-war years, $10 million a year. During the war years, $34 million a year, three times as much. Hey, kids, are you getting the picture? Well, cancer produces earnings like that. Disease produces profit, and that's why you have so much disease. We Americans have more disease today than we've ever had in our lives. And the cause is nutritional deficiency. And the guy that wrote the book Rare Earths, his name is Joel Wallach, spells it out in spades. Boys and girls, if you have high blood pressure, or you have diabetes, or you've got gout, nor muscular dystrophy or Alzheimer's disease, Joel Wallach will tell you what the nutritional deficiency is that causes those symptoms. And by the way, there's 450 of them. 450 symptoms. It's called the physician's desk reference. Every doctor's got one right on his desk. So when you come in and he asks you, he says, well, do you have a headache? Are you coughing? Do you have pain when you urinate? You know, he asks you for all of these symptoms, and then he takes all those symptoms, he goes over to the physician's desk reference. He puts your symptoms together, and he says, ah, I know what you've got. Diabetes. Okay, there's your diagnosis. Then he comes back, and he says, ah, and we've got a treatment. It's called insulin. Well, boys and girls, in your body, you've got an organ. It's called your pancreas. And you know, if you believe in God, or if you believe that you were created, this master designer, this creator God, he put this pancreas in your body. It makes insulin. It regulates your body's insulin need. Now, I don't know exactly how that works, you know, just being a crummy plumber and all, but, you know, I'm smart enough to figure out that if God put a pancreas in your body and it makes insulin or regulates the insulin, it's probably pretty necessary. It's probably a necessary part. Kind of like buying a Ford car, you know, and it's got a spare tire. It is true that the spare tire is just riding, you know, in the trunk of your car, not being used, but it is a very vital part to your automobile. And as soon as you have a flat tire, you'll see how vital the spare tire is. And like headlights, you know, your car will run nicely down the highway without any headlights. Now, when the sun goes down, it does pose a problem. So to solve the nighttime vision problem, they put headlights on your car. Now, it is true, you could come along and you can cut these organs out. They'll come along and they'll cut out your tonsils, they'll cut out your adenoids, they'll cut out your appendix, cut out your gallbladder. And it is true. Hell, I don't deny it. You can live without a gallbladder, but you'll live better with one. Your Ford car will run nicely without headlights, but it'll run better at night with them. So, you know, if you want to cut your organs out, well, go ahead. Now, the medicos, they come along and they say, oh, you've got gallstones. Well, no, what we'll do, we'll cut your gallbladder out. Did you know that you can dissolve those gallstones without surgery? Did you know that people have been having gallstones for thousands of years? Did you ever stop to think about, well, what were people doing about their gallstones 100, 500 years ago? Did you know that people had cancer 500 or 1,000 years ago and that they were doing something about it? These cures to cancer that I'm telling you about over here, it isn't something that was just discovered last month by the National Cancer Society. There's a lady by the name of Ann Wigmore. Change the subject here on you again. Ann Wigmore discovered that if you took wheat grass, now if you take wheat and you plant it, grass comes up. I don't know if you knew this or not, but wheat is a grass. It's like rye grass and Timothy grass and Bermuda grass. Wheat is a grass. And it grows up and it has a head on it, and this head has seeds, and these seeds, you grind them up and we make wheat flour. She discovered that if you cut this wheatgrass off when it's about 6 inches tall, you don't let it grow up until it turns into wheat and make Aunt Jemima pancakes now. Long before it turns into seeds, when it's just grass growing up, looks just like your lawn, except that instead of being grass, it's wheatgrass. You have barley grass. They make barley green out of barley grass. You could have rye grass. You can have wheat grass. You could have Timothy grass. Well, this lady, her name is Ann Wigmore, and she discovered that this wheat grass, just the green grass, if you cut it off and you juice it and you drink the juice, the cancer will go away. Did you know that? Now, at Wild Oats in Reno, Nevada, when I'm in Reno, I oftentimes go out to Wild Oats. You know, they're down on South Virginia. And I go in there, and they got a juice bar. And I say, well, give me a carrot juice with wheatgrass. And so they've got a box that comes in, and they take scissors, and they just cut the wheatgrass off with the scissors. And then they stick it into this hopper, and it runs through this machine, and then there's this green glop comes out. In the Wizard of Id, they call it swill, you know, for normal people, you know, they call it swill. Well, this swill that you put into your carrot juice, you can drink the stuff straight. You know, if you can get it down, you got to be pretty damn tough to drink that wheatgrass straight. But, you know, assuming that you can get it down, I put it in the carrot juice, kill the taste of it, and you get it down. Did you know that that'll cure cancer? Well, you know, let's put it this way. You got a person that's got a tumor, and it's a lump. Maybe it's on their arm or on their stomach or chest or back or someplace in their body. Or maybe it's inside, you know, and they've got ovarian cancer or breast cancer or something like that. And they got this lump, see, and so they, instead of going to have it cut out at the hospital, instead of having radiation, instead of having chemotherapy and your hair falling out and all this, instead of doing that, they go to Wild Oats and they drink this wheatgrass. Or like my wife did when she was diagnosed with cancer back in 78, they built a greenhouse onto our house here. And here in my office, just looking out my door, I see my greenhouse. And my wife was growing wheatgrass out there in her greenhouse. And every day she would cut that wheatgrass off with her scissors. And then she'd go upstairs and she'd juice it in her Walker juicer. And she did that for 2 years and 8 months. And her cancer went away. Did you know that? It's what we call remission. And she used the Ann Wigmore program. And so the Ann Wigmore program is wheatgrass. And that's what Joel Wallach discovered. That there's something in this wheatgrass. And it's what we call minerals. Minerals. And if you don't have these minerals, you develop one of these symptoms that the doctor goes to the physician's desk reference. to find out what these symptoms are. And he says, okay, well, we've got a symptom here. We put it down the list and we find out you've got diabetes, and the diabetes protocol calls for insulin, so we're going to put you on insulin. Okay, now they got a cash cow for life. As long as you're on insulin, you got to go to the doctor to get a prescription. You got to go to the pharmacy to get it filled. And it's a miracle. I mean, you know, as far as you're concerned, you're going to die with this diabetes unless you can control it. And so, hey, we can control diabetes. Now, how would you like to cure it? Now, just off the top of your head, what would you think if I said, did you know that you can eat vitamins and minerals? You could change your diet and you could rebuild your pancreas. And I know if you go to your medical doctor, he'll say, that guy Gordon's lying to you. Well, of course he's going to tell you that. Do you know what's going to happen? If you were to cure your diabetes, do you know what would happen? The doctor loses a cash cow. Are you going to go back to your doctor and pay him $50 a month to monitor your diabetes after it goes away and you're cured? Boys and girls, there isn't any money in peace. There's money to be made in war. And that's why we have lots of war and not very much peace. Boys and girls, can you understand that there's a lot of money to be made in disease? Diabetes makes a lot of money. If you cured that diabetes, or worse, if you prevented that diabetes, then there's no cash cow, there's no profits, there's no money to be made by the medical establishment. If there's peace, then there's no death by war. See these 4,000 Americans that died in Iraq in the war over there so far. If there hadn't been any war over there, those 4,000 guys would still be alive. And the $10 billion a month that you're spending on this war, see how much money that is. You've been at war now for 5 years, that's 60 months. Times 10, that's 500. That's $500 billion. That's a half a trillion dollars you've spent on this war. That half a trillion dollars was spent on buying powder from DuPont, airplanes from Lockheed and Boeing, buying gasoline from Standard Oil to fly airplanes with, and so on. See, all of that produces money. Halliburton, if you were to take a look at Halliburton, they're making more money now than they were before the war because they're defense contractors. And that's what Smedley Butler pointed out. And so that's why this War as a Racket is such a neat book, because, you know, the guy just kind of lays it right out in spades and says, the reason that we have World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan is because it makes lots of profit. Doesn't have anything to do with national security. Doesn't do anything for making America safe, or making the world safe for democracy, or making Iraq safe for democracy. It has to do with making profit for DuPont, Boeing Aircraft, Standard Oil, and Shell. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, same thing works here when we're talking about cancer. Cancer is a racket. It makes money for Searle and Pfizer and Merck. It makes money for doctors, makes money for hospitals, makes money for cancer research. These people are getting grants. And this guy, Bruce Halstead, comes along and says, hey, wait a minute, what we need is more vitamins and minerals. We need more Laetrile. We need more wheatgrass. There's no money in wheatgrass. There's no money in vitamins and minerals. The money is in oncology. The money is in bypass surgery. All right, kids, I'm out of time again. I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.